Dear listener, if you like this podcast, I want to tell you about something else you might enjoy as well. Every week, I host an online meetup. In each meeting, I give a presentation on some programming topic, or I bring a guest to the group for a discussion, or I do a code review on a member's code base, or I do some kind of consultation with one of our members. Coming to this meetup is kind of like listening to this podcast, except it's live and interactive, which means you get a chance to ask questions and participate in a conversation with other programmers like yourself. The meetup is also a fun place to meet some new friends. To learn more and to sign up, visit codewithjason.com/meetup. Now on to the episode. Hey, today I'm here with Eric Cameron. Eric, welcome to the show.
Hi, glad to be here.
Glad to have you here. So Eric, you and I got connected through Mike Stone of the NAR company, which is where you work as well, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep, I'm a software developer at the NAR company. I do work on one of our contracts for the state of Massachusetts involving rideshare regulation.
Okay. And you said pre-show that you've been thinking a lot about containerization lately. Tell me about that.
Yeah, it's a relevant topic as it's, you know, we're looking at our infrastructure, on the project I work on and what the future of that is going to look like, of course. We're kind of always looking at that. I have some personal projects that I, you know, was toying around with new stuff going on there. And I'm pretty, at least, hopeful about the future of WebAssembly. And I think that probably what seems like maybe the least appreciated part about it is the possibilities for containerization that it offers. I think people think about it a lot in terms of, you know, just ending JavaScript's monopoly on client-side code. And, you know, that's obviously significant. But it feels like some of a lot of the interesting stuff that's going on in the WebAssembly world is looking at how, you know, maybe even server-side stuff, where you can use the fundamentally sandboxed nature of it to create much stronger container environments than, things like Linux containers or FreeBSD jails or what have you.
Okay. I know basically nothing about WebAssembly. Can you help me understand what that is?
Sure. So this is a project. I'm pretty sure it started at Mozilla, though. Fact check me on that. I'm pretty sure. But it's a way to send binary code to a client that initially that understands JavaScript, basically in the browser, right? So this is interesting because you can make WebAssembly a target for most compiled languages that can output static binaries and stuff like that. So Rust is really popular in the WebAssembly world. And I think probably people look at it and they're like, I don't need to run Rust in my web browser, but that's probably, at least related to it. Maybe it hasn't caught on as much in other language communities. But there's some really cool stuff going on in other circles. Like there's a project called WASM Cloud that I've been following with a little bit of interest. And they have a whole architecture that's based on you write what they call actors. And I know that's kind of an overloaded term, right? But an actor for them is a cryptographically signed WebAssembly module with predefined inputs and outputs that it's granted and tasks that it can perform. It's basically invoked by a big mesh network message bus, right? I mean, I'm sure the folks at that project will have more to say about that. But this is interesting, right? Because the way they position this is a framework for writing entire features that you can ship as binaries, and that only know about the inputs and outputs that you provide them, that you declare for them. And that's guaranteed through cryptographic signing, right? So this eliminates a whole bunch of the surface attack area, you know, of a normal, say, a POSIX operating system, which is what you will typically find underneath most application logic in the cloud now, right? You know, you've got like a Ruby on Rails application or something, right? And then that's running on a Docker container, which is based on a Linux kernel. And, you know, the Docker container is basically a functional Linux runtime. It might be small, it's whatever, but you have the entire, you know, surface attack area of the kernel available to you, for example, for security purposes, right? There is a standard in WebAssembly called WASI, that's the WebAssembly System Interface, that's designed to be a sort of, not POSIX-like, but it's like it's a framework for accessing system utilities that an underlying operating system can pass into a WASM runtime. Say, here, you're allowed to use these. And it's granular to like the level of like a file descriptor. So it's possible to build these very secure server-side environments in WebAssembly cut down, a lot of the sort of the front doors for a lot of the sort of attacks we're used to, you know. So so I think in a couple of years, you know, we may be looking at WASI isolation as, you know, one of the dominant ways of containerizing applications on the internet. That was sort of a rambling answer, but it's that.
Well, I have a lot to learn. I will be completely honest and say that I understood very little of that due to my lack of relevant knowledge.
I lacked it myself a few months ago, to be clear. Like, I mean, not all that long ago, I was in that, oh, cool, you know, I can write C programs for my web browser. Who cares? You know, and I didn't know. And then I kind of did this deep dive on it. And it was like, it was really eye opening. So,
okay. So I want to try to understand this somehow and kind of explain it for the listener and whatnot. Maybe the first thing I want to ask, the first way I want to try to come at it is, what took you down this road?
So good question. The thing that I initially started thinking about was, I know this is a little far afield, but AI, such as, you know, the large language models, as we're all seeing in the news these days, you know, I'm thinking to myself, like, how is this going to change, you know, what we do at the NAR, you know, we basically do a sort of form of retail programming where people come in with, you know, application logic that they need filled out. And we rely on a lot of pre-existing tools like Ruby on Rails commonly, you know, or Phoenix, you know, to build these solutions for them. But like, how is this going to change what we do? Right. And it's like, okay, so what will it look like when, you know, the ability to code, you know, to ask AIs to generate code for you, you know, when that's a mature thing, what is it going to look like? Right. The thought experiment for me ended with, well, they're probably going to ship binaries, right? Because if for all the reasons, you know, that binaries are advantageous, for one thing, I mean, they're smaller, you know, they, whatever. They're not reverse engineered, which they're you can reverse engineer them, but they're not scripts you can read, which has interesting maybe implications for open source. They're faster than interpreted languages. And if your ultimate target is going to be a binary anyway, it's not clear to me why you would ask the AI to generate an intermediate representation that was readable by humans.
Wait, let me pause there a second. This seems worth digging into a little bit.
Yeah.
So you were thinking about like what the future of AI generated code looks like when it's mature, and maybe you're hypothesizing that it will send binaries instead of human readable code. What takes you to that idea?
I think that the main reason we don't do that is it has to do with developer tooling and like what makes it, you know, what makes it, I don't want to say easy, but like what's felicitous for web developers, right? I mean, that was a lot of the argument for Ruby on Rails, right? Developer experience, like you are, you know, you can work quickly and work at a high level in this, you know, very expressive language that, you know. But if you take away that, and presumably that's not an issue for the AI, right? Like, if you take that out of the equation, you know, what is the argument for shipping human-readable, interpreted languages, you know, into production effectively, right? Hmm. And I know not everybody does that, right? But a lot of people do that to some degree, right? I think most of us, like, if you run, like, a Ruby on Rails application or a Node application or an Elixir application, whatever it is, you know, a language like that, I think you probably consider the primary representation of your program to be the human-readable text in Ruby or Elixir or, you know, whatever it is, right? And that, you know, to the extent that that gets, like, transmuted into some binary for the computer's purpose, that is sort of an implementation detail, right? Now, if you ship binaries, like, chances are you think the primary representation of your application is the binary representation, right? Because that's what you're sort of sending out. And like I said, I know there are cases that sort of fall right on the edge of this, right? But it's not clear to me why you would ask an AI to generate human-readable representations of a web application.
Okay.
If you have, you know, if you have the option to just have it generate a binary that's portable and et cetera.
Okay. Interesting. Well, I don't buy it.
Cool. This is great. I want to hear this.
Yeah. Okay. So, like, don't you think that a custom software system needs to be, at least in principle, understandable by a human?
I do. I definitely do. And there's a sort of, there's a second part to this argument, but I think you've hit on the, you know, the crux of the problem with it is that people don't trust AI, right?
Well, I mean, it's not a matter of trust.
Well, I'm going somewhere with this. Okay. I agree with you that it's ultimately not real. I mean, it sort of is and isn't, but like this line of thought is like, you know, it starts with like, well, first of all, like, what is the argument for human labor on some level? But like, I think part of the answer to that question is that nobody trusts, you know, AI, like, not even the people who sell it trust it, right? I mean, just watch testimony in front of Congress recently, right? But so if you go to somebody, and ultimately it doesn't matter whether it's AI or, you know, a sketchy software vendor you met on Craigslist, right? You go to somebody and you give them some money and they hand you some executable code, you know, like, it's reasonable for you to want to verify the behavior of it, right? I think that, or at least I think it's possible that as the scenario we'll wind up with is one in which we ask AI to generate binaries for us, but they're binaries that operate at a fairly small granular level that are easily verifiable by humans, you know, via unit testing, say, right?
Okay.
Because that's kind of like is the best of both worlds on some level, right? I mean, you know, and this is something we think about, like a lot of us think about as programmers, like as object-oriented programmers, you know, maybe some of us have heard the expression program to the interface, not the implementation, right? You know, we're trained to sort of abstract out implementation details, you know, and look at the behavior of an API, you know, as a sort of a black box. That's how we use libraries that other people write, you know. And I think that's ultimately how we'll wind up using libraries or binaries written by AIs as well, you know. But there's a powerful argument for human labor there in terms of the verification step of that. Like, you know, I can easily imagine a future where the binaries are where you ship binaries, right? But the test suite is still in a very high level human readable language because the test suite needs to be. That's what needs to be intelligible to humans, right?
Okay. Yeah. All right. So I've gone from my stance is I don't buy it to my stance is maybe I buy it if I understand what you're saying. So okay,
I want to emphasize again, yeah, if I can, this is idle fantasy. This is one future among many possible ones. Like,
yeah,
you know, it's sort of game playing out this idea a little bit though.
So. Yeah, I can imagine so many possible scenarios for the future, but it's like how exactly will it play out? Who knows? But like, I can see how that might go. Like, for example, if I draw a parallel between like Linux utilities, like I've never looked at the code for grep, for example, but I've used grep like every day for 15 years. And I have a strong belief that it works the way I understand it to work. And so it doesn't matter that I haven't looked at the code for it. So I can imagine a scenario where I ask an AI for a tiny program that does something like the size of grep or something like that. And somehow I come to believe that it does what I think it does. And it, for that reason, I don't feel a need to look at its... I don't feel a need to have access to its source code. Is that kind of the idea?
Yeah, exactly.
Interesting.
And I think it has a, that system or that kind of scenario has a natural preference for small units, like, you know, like grep or, you know, the sort of the standard toolkit there, you know, because I wouldn't, if I had to verify something as a black box like that, I would not ask an AI to ship me Microsoft Word, you know? Like it's so large and so complex that the task of verifying it would be, you know, really difficult. Whereas like if you can ask the AI to generate, you know, small chunks that you can verify their behavior independently and then combine them, you know, in interesting ways, then yeah, the system is more verified from the bottom up in that way, which I think is similar to the argument for unit tests overall.
Okay. Well, that's very interesting. Yeah, that seems like totally plausible. And it seems like logical. For some reason, I feel like I would be surprised if it actually turns out that way. Maybe for the reason that like, then your program would be like a mix of these, like, because you couldn't compose your entire program out of these binaries, it seems like. So it seems like you'd have a mix of these binaries and traditional human readable code. And maybe that mix wouldn't be awkward, but it kind of feels like it would be.
Yeah, I mean, it could be. I think there's, you know, I mean, that there is that possibility along kind of every API boundary where, you know, different parties are responsible for the other sides of the code, right? I guess this, you know, and maybe this circles back to, this is how it circles back to the original prompt, was part of me feels like what would make that happen or not happen would be how easy it was, right? I mean, like the tooling around it, like, you know, if it's easy to ship software that way and it's economically efficient, then, you know, yeah, then maybe it's a more plausible scenario. And this is kind of how I wound up thinking about WebAssembly, by the way, because I started thinking, I'm like, what format would you want it to output? And all of a sudden it started occurring to me that WebAssembly like checks all these boxes. It's portable. The underlying system interface, you know, WASI, if they can, you know, settle on something that everybody can agree on, you know, that'll make it easy to, you know, move, you know, from one platform to another. Yeah, the module thing is already there. And then like WASM Cloud, you know, that project or projects like that, like one of the things they introduce is the ability to cryptographically sign modules, right? So that's something you'd want. Like, oh, if I could have like a message-oriented kind of architecture where I could plug in these binary modules I was getting from the AI and unit testing offline or whatever, but I could just kind of plug these into a runtime where, you know, they're described declaratively in terms of their inputs and outputs, that might hey, that could work. And I'm realizing it's like, wow, this is basically like, you know, what WASM Cloud and folks like them are building right now. So anyway, that was that was how it circled back. So, you know, I'm wondering about a future, I guess, in which, you know, the containerization and sandboxing, you know, offered by a WebAssembly runtime, you know, might be what makes, you know, shipping, you know, these kind of AI generated binaries, maybe that's what makes it viable somehow. I don't know.
Yeah, interesting.
Again, this is idle speculation. So.
Yeah. So like WebAssembly, maybe like one of the mediums through which these binaries could be conveyed.
Right. And I guess I started kind of asking myself, it's like, all right, suppose, you know, you're going to the AI software shop, right? And you're like, hey, AI, you know, build me a little module that does this. Like, what, you know, what other formats would I consider asking for it in? You know, I mean, you could ask for it like a translation of it in a human readable language, but you'd have no real guarantee that what you were testing was what you were executing.
Like, yeah.
You know, you could ask for it in a non-portable binary format, but kind of why, you know, and maybe for performance reasons and certain, I'm sure like, you know, for super performance critical stuff that, you know, will be a thing, you know, but, for most application logic and web applications, that's not really, you know, an issue. I would hope, for it to be platform and kind of framework independent, you know, as a consumer, you know, like I love Ruby on Rails, you know, when you commit to writing a Ruby on Rails application, you're committing to a lot of, I don't want to call it technical debt. It's just technical commitment, you know, over the lifetime of that application where, you know, your wagon is really hitched to Rails. You know, that probably, you know, is the why certain applications, you know, phase out. If people say like, well, you know, we're looking at a new framework and maybe we should be considering what we need in 10 years, right? And making decisions about their application that way. If you had a system where each, you know, where your individual features, your application logic packages, where they weren't really dependent on some or less dependent on the underlying platform in that way, you'd maybe be able to make more piecemeal decisions, you know?
Yeah, interesting. Well, I'll have to chew on that idea for a while because that is a new thought that I haven't encountered yet. You know, I can share some, if you're interested, I can share some thoughts about where I imagine things potentially going. So to preface, like in my experimentation with ChatGPT, I haven't found it very good, at least not yet, for writing large chunks of application code. Partly because, you know, writing large chunks of application code is not something I like ever do anyway, because my workflow is more test oriented. So I'm usually writing the tests, which I think of as the specifications, and then I write the code that meets the specifications. And so if I write the code first, that's backwards. And what am I going to do? Like backfill it with tests or something like that? It just doesn't make a lot of sense to me. I've been working on this Vim plugin because I'm a Vim user.
Me too.
I can give a prompt that says, write me a test that does such and such. And then, all right, this is a mix of what actually exists and where I'm going with the plugin. So not all of this actually exists yet, but you can give it a prompt that says, write me a certain test. And then on my left tmux pane in Vim, it'll give me the code for that test. And then on my right tmux pane, it'll run that test. And then it'll send the failure message to GPT, and it will give me back the code to make that failure message go away. And then I'll get that code in a new tab. It'll run the test again, And presumably I'll get a new failure message. It'll send that to GPT. And that cycle just repeats until that test is satisfied. And then we start over with a new test case. And that's part of the way done. It's pretty neat to watch because a lot of those steps that I just described are still manual. But to watch it write a test for me and then write the code for me is so neat because I still have to do, in a sense, I still have to do most of the thinking because like coming up with the requirements and specifying the exact behavior you want is kind of the hard part. And writing the syntax to make it all work is the easy part. But it's still kind of a lot of mental labor to come up with all that syntax. And so to have that all happen automatically is pretty neat. And so I can imagine a future where people are using tools like that.
Yeah, everything you just said sounds like very familiar. And I think that's kind of how, that's the happy ending, I think, you know, for this story. I sometimes think about, I don't know about you, I'm a big Star Trek fan. That the way people interact with the ship's computer on like Star Trek The Next Generation, say, is this is another way in which they might have seen into the future a little bit. They have kind of this, it's sort of what you're describing, right? This sort of collaborative relationship with the ship's computer. Well, they'll give it a prompt, it says something, they'll kind of, you know, and it's an iterative process when the human is not like run out of the room in any way. Right?
Yeah. Yeah, because it's still like, you know, there's the idea of AI taking programmers' jobs and stuff like that. But it's like, at some point, I had this all articulated at one point in time. So let me see if I can access that memory right now. But it's like, humans have desires. We have emotions and desires and all that stuff. And machines don't. And it's like a meaningless idea, like the idea of a machine wanting something like that, just it doesn't make sense. And so like, you know, I used the example of like a restaurant before and somebody said to me like, well, you know, AI could like decide the best kind of restaurant to have in a certain neighborhood and menu items to offer and stuff like that. And it's like, yeah, like sure. But like to even have the idea in the first place to say, you know what I want to do with my life? I want to start a restaurant and I want it to be a an Italian restaurant or whatever it may be. It's like that stuff is like completely I don't want to say only humans, but like only organic beings or whatever have desires in that way. You know what I mean?
100%. I think, you know, consciousness, subjectivity is the element that, you know, that's just not there, that I would see no reason to think was there, you know, no matter how convincing a simulation, you know. I 100% hear what you're saying. And that the labor question sort of lurks behind this, you know, in a lot of ways, for a lot of people who listen to your podcast, I'd imagine. I know for a lot of people I work with, you know, it's not everything, but it's a question. You
know? Oh, what do you mean by that?
Just the extent to which, you know, it will impact the ability for people to make a living as a programmer.
Oh, yeah. You know? Yeah.
And how it'll change the ability to get into the profession and stuff like that.
Yeah, I definitely think it'll have profound economic effects. I think a lot of the effects that people are predicting right now are probably oversimplified and very wrong. Not to say I have the right answers, just it's like, how will it go? I don't know, but not like that.
Can you say more? I want to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah. So like wielding AI is like a skill. And like if you take somebody who's not very skilled or not very smart and they use ChatGPT to generate a program, they're probably just going to create a bigger mess faster. Like if you are not a programmer at all and you want to like build some like one-off scripts and stuff like that, ChatGPT enhances your ability. It like it adds a it adds to your ability. It doesn't multiply your ability, but it like adds maybe. And then if you're like really unskilled, it multiplies your ability by either a number much less than one or a negative number. And then if you're really good, it multiplies your ability by a positive number. Because like, well, maybe there's not much more explanation needed, but like if you're a really skilled programmer, for example, you'll ask ChatGPT to write you a test and it'll give you that test and you'll say, wow, this is terrible. I'm not going to use this. And then you'll go manually write the test yourself, or it'll give you the test and you'll say, great, this is perfect. You'll have the skills to recognize the quality of what you get back, whereas somebody who's less skilled, again, will just use it uncritically. So that's my and I guess to bring it into the to bring back the economic component to that, I think what that means is people who recognize those realities will be willing to pay the really good programmers, like, I'm hesitant to say a number, but, you know, instead of the best programmers getting paid $200,000 a year, they'll get paid $1 million or $2 million a year. And the really mediocre programmers, well, they might not even have a place in the industry anymore. And then people who are just kind of okay, maybe they'll get paid like $50,000 or something like that. It'll be like a winner takes most type situation is a possibility.
Interesting. Yeah. Yeah. I think you're right about how it'll change, you know, like the nature of, you know, what skills are required to, you know, to be an entry level programmer, what skills are required to be, you know, a top level programmer for sure. The thing I've been thinking about a lot was how in the late 90s, there were all these people like, you know, like Microsoft, you know, saying that free software was going to kill the professional programming industry, you know, because they're like, duh, you make a thing, you sell it, and you're just giving it away, you know? And, you know, of course, the exact opposite happened, you know? I mean, the rise of free software and open source was, you know, one of the pillars of the explosion of the consumer internet as we know it. There are a lot more programmers now than there were, you know, in the late 90s. But the demands are different, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It's like where the level of abstraction keeps rising. Yeah, we're still doing programming, but the nature of it is different than it was decades ago. Is that kind of what you mean?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I mean, some things are easier, right? You have higher level tools in some ways. Some things are harder, and some things I think are just kind of out of left field. Like the thing I think about is like how much, like in order to be to get into the programming, you know, industry these days, you actually have to have pretty decent people skills, right? And this was notoriously not the case for a really long time, right? And I think what happened was, you know, the demand for programming, for code, like created a situation in which there just aren't enough like under-socialized neckbeards on planet Earth to meet it, you know? So like the nature of like, you know, what you're looking for a person skill wise changed, you know, because, you know, you have to now have this profession that you can scale up to, you know, and that's a good thing for inclusivity. That's a good thing for, you know, people putting dinner on the table from writing code, you know? And ultimately, you know, it means like, you know, you can't be a guy who just sits in the basement grumbling at other people all day long, you know? So.
Interesting. So how does that work? Like, why was that acceptable before, but maybe it's less acceptable now?
I think, you know, it's a sort of supply and demand thing where like, you know, there was a certain people who needed programming done, you know, in the 80s and 90s, since whenever they really need it done. There's money there, you know.
Okay. Yeah, and you don't have a choice. You just have to hire the grumpy neckbeard guy.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think this is a really important point to note. I can't remember where it is, but when you look at, like, at some point in the 70s or 80s, like, this became a male-dominated field. Like, it wasn't, right?
Right.
It was, and I forget, like, where it is, you know, in the 70s or 80s or something, but, like, you look at a graph, and there's a point where, like, you know, the enrollment of women in computer science programs, like, falls off a cliff. Right. Again, fact check me on this and yeah. everything. But, you know, and I've always wondered about that, about like, you know, it's like, how is this, you know, changed? Like, you know, how has this prevented a professional culture from taking root in the first place in a lot of ways, you know?
Yeah.
But we have to have a professional culture now because like we have to, you know, there are too many programming jobs, you know? It has to be an inclusive industry.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a real... There's... Man, the whole thing is so interesting because it's like there's all these organizations that are desperate for good programmers and there's all these people who want programming jobs, but it doesn't all match up because... You know, just because there might be a million open jobs and a million programmers seeking a job doesn't mean they all just match up with each other. There's obviously a preference for experienced people. And so people who don't have very much experience who are trying to get into the industry, my understanding is it's just brutal because, you know, it's that chicken egg problem where you need to get experience in order to get your foot in the door, but you need to already be in there in order to gain the experience. And they're not making any new programmers with 20 years of experience because that opportunity ran out 20 years ago. And so, yeah, I don't know what's going to happen in the future, but it's a tough situation.
Yeah, everything you just said is 100% true, you know. And it's, you know, it's compatible with there also being a ton of programming jobs, like you're saying. It's like, you know, yeah, I think maybe a certain amount of that is how hiring managers and, you know, team leaders and stuff, you know, maybe how they're thinking about kind of what value they're getting from that experience, you know, because like there are a lot of people with 20 years of experience writing, you know, Java in, you know, the banking world, you know, whereas, you know, if you need a good test-driven suite of front-end tooling for a web application, you know, a junior developer is probably going to be a better bet there, you know. If what you really need, to circle back to what we were talking about like AI-driven software, and what you touched on was how test-driven development is already basically AI-friendly, you know, if what you really need is somebody who can think rationally about how a system works, you know, and give the necessary and sufficient conditions for each kind of behavior, you know, then like, you know, maybe 20 years of experience, you know, writing C++ is not what you're looking for.
You know? Yeah. Yeah.
Maybe you want a philosophy major.
Yeah. No, like some of the best people I've worked with have majored in something other than computer science. Philosophy is definitely one of them. You know, I saw this graph of like it plotted IQ against a person's major. And interestingly, philosophy was like way up there. It was like right next to physics and math, which was a little bit surprising to me, but also at the same time not surprising. Yeah, I don't know exactly what that story is there, but I thought that was an interesting anecdote.
As somebody with a philosophy major, I'd like to see the sample set on that. But
what was I going to say? Yeah, programming jobs, supply and demand. I don't know what I was going to say. But yeah, I think AI... This goes back to something we were talking about earlier regarding the level of abstraction rising and rising over time. I don't know if AI-assisted programming raises the level of abstraction or if it does something different. I think maybe it does something different, which is it just saves mental grunt work. Because the output is like the same level of abstraction. And I think the programmer still has to understand all the same stuff. Because it's like, I don't know, there was this little saying or something. This doctor was like, I can teach you how to remove somebody's appendix in 4 minutes. But if you want to know what to do when something goes wrong, it'll take me 4 years to teach you that.
Right.
Where like, yeah, if you're using AI to generate code and everything is just fine, then that'll be just fine. But then if it gives you something that's like subtly wrong, like you're screwed hopelessly. And so you still need to actually be a good programmer.
Definitely. Yeah. And I don't think anything is going to fundamentally change that. And what you're absolutely right about, like, the level of abstraction is different from, like, you know, having grunt work done by a robot, you know. I do think there's one of the places where I see that level of abstraction increasing is in things like, you know, WASM Cloud or like, you know, runtimes like that, where the approach of sandboxing through abstraction, right? Like, basically saying we're not going to give you the opportunity to screw up, like, you know, in various ways by presenting a very high level, you know, interface for you to work with, which I suspect like will be a big part of dealing with AI shipped code, you know, because like I said, I mean, it the fact that it was generated by an AI may not be, you know, important in and of itself, but I think it may bring to light, you know, this issue of, for people's minds, like, how do I trust this code that I got, right? You know, and sandboxing that by running it in an abstracted layer, I think will probably be a thing.
Yeah, I think that makes sense to me. That reminds me of a fairly unrelated thing, but I was working on an application earlier today. I was working on Dockerizing an application that wasn't Dockerized yet. And it made me think, like, well, I've had this thought before, like, I am less than 100% comfortable with the idea of like, okay, hang on, let me back up. So interfacing with AI currently is tedious. Like, I go to ChatGPT, I type a prompt, I maybe copy paste some code and paste it in my editor. Then I copy other code out of my editor, paste it into ChatGPT, ask a question, stuff like that. There's a lot of friction in that process. And so I'm thinking, like, you know, we already have the technology to get rid of a lot of this friction. Like, there's no reason, for example, I don't know of any technological reason why we couldn't have just AI continuously watching a video of my screen, and it uses OCR to capture the text on my screen, and it uses text to speech or speech to text. So I can just say, instead of copy pasting a piece of code, I just say like, hey, see this piece of code right here? Modify it in such and such way, in the same way that I might say to a pair programmer or something like that. And then there's various things that I would like AI to be able to do for me on my computer without me having to do them manually. But I'm less than 100% comfortable with the idea of an AI just completely taking over my computer with all my accounts signed in and all that stuff. And so one other idea I had for where things might go is maybe in the future, you might have, for example, a copy of your application on some cloud machine or something like, or even like a local containerized machine or something like that. Again, something sandboxed, and the AI operates there. And so it's like you ask the AI to do something and it operates in a sandboxed environment, and then it gives you the result back, but it's not like given control over your personal system.
100%. Yes. Yeah. And I think that that's, that feeds into, you know, the approach of, you know, of WASM Cloud and WebAssembly components generally, where you have to declare their, their inputs and their outputs explicitly, you know, and they can't interact with any resource you haven't given them permission to at the jump, like at the point when the program executes. And which means it's really easy to implement patterns like you just described, where it's like, here's the input, you know, here's the state that I just checked out of my data store, whatever it is, do something to it. And I'm going to take the result back, and I can either commit it, you know, back to the data store as a legitimate update. I can throw it away because it's bogus, whatever it is. But yeah, 100%. I think that pattern you just described is going to be a big part of it. And the other thing to think about too is that, like, that problem of state management, like what constitutes authoritative state. I kind of doubt like AI will make a ton of inroads there on some level, because it's sort of like there's not a lot of incentive to have AI rewrite Postgres, right? You know, like, here's a thing we know works, and we know works with human verification, and, like, you know, there's an organization behind it that has its own sort of financial independence or whatever, you know, you're not worried about them being beholden to whatever. It's, you know, AI is not going to give you anything better on the trust front there. So, like, a fault line between application logic, which there's a constant demand for, you know, and back-end storage logic, which you can recycle a lot. I think, you know, you may see a divide there between what people use AI for and not also.
Can you expand on that? I'm not sure I understand yet.
Sure. You know, Postgres, and I'm using Postgres as an example here. I mean, I think it's a good example. I think there are probably database projects that people trust less, you know. But Postgres is a good example for this when you think about, like, how much of the, you know, the world's data, you know, resides in, which is a lot, not as much as Excel, not as much as maybe. But, you know, to implement that pattern, like you're saying, right, where, like, the AI executes in some sandboxed area and you get what it gives you back, and you can kind of treat that separately. Like, I mean, presumably, like, you know, at some point you're going to want to commit that, you know, like when you save a file to disk or, you know, commit a database transaction, you know, from a sort of semantic perspective in the application, you're saying, you know, this is the truth now. Right?
Yeah. Yeah. And that's a whole different thing I've thought about. Like, even if you have AI helping you work, I don't see any way around, or if you'd even want to have a way around, deciding those units of work.
What was that? Can you say more about that?
Yeah. So, like, you know, there's a great variance in, like, what a programmer considers a unit of work. Like, I might do 5 minutes of work and commit something. It's three lines and I commit it because I want my commits to be atomic, so that this three line commit right now doesn't pollute my 12 line commit that I'm going to do in a few minutes. And to me, those units of work matter very much. I'm going to label them very deliberately, because everything that I commit is going to be susceptible to archaeology later, and I'm going to want that archaeology to be easy, and I'm not going to want the past to be a mystery. So all this stuff takes a lot of deliberate thought, and it's very subjective. Whereas another programmer might code for hours and then commit something that just says WIP, and that's fine with them, even though I think that's objectively worse, but that's what somebody else might do. And so if you give an AI agent kind of control over that stuff, how's it going to know? Like, it doesn't seem to match. It seems like you'll always want to have control over that part.
Yeah. You know, I think that gets to the, or I'm connecting it at least in my head to, you know, the issue of, like, what is the granularity of the work that's being output by AIs, you know? Like, yeah. Hopefully we're getting something like grep rather than something like Microsoft Word, right? You know? Yeah. Because that unit of work issue, it's like, because the unit of the sort of the size of that quanta, you know, of, you know, is basically sets the your visibility into the system, right?
Yeah.
It's your ability to verify its behavior.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that like the speed limit of productivity is going to be determined by human intelligence, not artificial intelligence. Like it has to cater to our stupidity and it's never going to be able to be faster than that.
That's a great way of putting it.
Sadly, I have a hard stop at the end of the hour, so we have to wrap up soon.
No problem.
This has been a really fascinating conversation.
Thank you. It's been really,
Yeah, and hopefully you're up for coming on again. But before we go, is there anywhere where people should go to online to find out what you're up to and all that stuff?
Check out the NAR Company website. We've got a blog that's up there that gets a lot of updates from my coworkers who are awesome and have lots of great things to say. If you need something from us, we would be happy to hear from you.
All right. Well, Eric, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks so much, Jason. Yeah, looking forward to it again.